Welcome to the Ithaca Radio Hour, a weekly program of news, views, culture, and events in our area. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Today is Monday, May 12th, 2003. This week, we continue the series Living in the Watershed and feature an interview with local filmmaker James Levesque. First, Congressman Maurice Hinchey discusses media regulation and the FCC. On June 2nd, the FCC will decide on proposed rules to further deregulate media ownership. Last Monday, Congressman Hinchey announced a congressional resolution to delay the discussion to allow for more public comment. We spoke with Maurice after his talk.
I'm introducing in the House this week a resolution calling upon the Federal Communications Commission not to move forward with their ruling, which will allow people who own radio and television frequencies to also own the newspapers in any media market. What we're seeing is the increasing consolidation of the means of information distribution in our country. It's falling in the hands of fewer and fewer people. It's a very dangerous thing in any kind of a democratic republic such as ours.
The Telecommunications Act of 1996 weakened ownership limits within a particular medium. For example, Clear Channel Communications owned 40 stations in 1995 and today owns over 1,200. The consequence has been a loss of local content.
Very often, news programs are wiped out, first of all, because they're expensive, and the reason that people own these radio stations is just to make money, not to serve the community.
The rule changes under consideration would allow consolidation across media, meaning one company, such as Clear Channel, could not only monopolize your radio dial, but also own the local television station and newspaper. With a rule change of such great potential impact, the FCC has deemed only one public hearing necessary. Although the national media have filed comments in favor of relaxed ownership rules, they have not covered the issue in their newscasts.
No corporation owns the airwaves. The airwaves are owned by the people of the United States.
To get more information and find out what you can do to stop the FCC, visit our website at IthacaRadio.org. This is Jeff Kirby reporting for Ithaca Community Radio.
It has actually been a long road as a filmmaker to get the film seen by large audiences. Even though it's been in 24 film festivals and won, I think, something like 8 awards for best documentary, TV broadcasters have been hesitant to broadcast the film. And these days, they're often hesitant to broadcast any film that will put out a message that will be perceived as against the interests of some powerful commercial interest.
This Thursday night at 10 p.m., WCNY-TV will air The Witness, the story of a Brooklyn construction contractor turned animal rights advocate. Linda Orkin spoke to producer James Levesque this past week.
Hi, my name is Linda Orkin. We're here at the Ithaca Radio Studios. I'm speaking with James Levesque. He's the producer of a documentary called The Witness, which is going to be shown on WCNY Central New York Public Television on Thursday, May 15th from 10 to 11. James, welcome.
Hi.
Hi. I guess the first question I have is, many people have seen this, and many people have been powerfully affected by it. I would like you to just give us a short summary of the film and how Eddie and you met and became involved in this project together.
The film tells the story of a man named Eddie Lama, who went through a dramatic transformation in his relationship to animals. And that may be true in many people's lives, but what makes the film especially interesting is that Eddie is a particularly unlikely animal advocate. He grew up in a home where animals were feared and even despised in some cases, and he adopted his family's values toward animals and really didn't question them well into his adulthood. And more or less what happened was that in searching to get a date with a woman he was attracted to, he agreed to babysit her kitten. And what happened was that in the process of taking the kitten into his life, he discovered that this animal wasn't anything like he was taught animals were. And it began with one kitten, and then Eddie first thought that this one animal was really great, but then another cat came into his life, and then he was thinking, wow, cats. Now, cats are great. Forget those other animals. And then a third cat came into his life, and then he started to think, you know, I really feel very connected to all animals. And the film chronicles the rather remarkable and very swift transformation of him from this person who really avoided animals and feared them to becoming one of their most powerful advocates in New York City. And then he went on to invent a truly remarkable form of public street-level education called Faunavision, where he took his message of the truth of animal suffering in video form and took one of his construction vans, he's a construction contractor, and he put a large format TV in it, some speakers, a message board, and really created kind of a mobile audiovisual theater to present this information on the streets of New York. And the effect on onlookers on the streets is extremely moving and very powerful. It was a brilliant invention. And the conclusion of the film focuses on the reaction of New Yorkers on the streets to the very powerful information he's presenting. In terms of where I connected with Eddie, my partner Jenny Stein, who is the co-founder of our organization, Tribe of Heart, and also the director and editor of the film, the two of us went to a conference in Washington, D.C. about animal issues. It was the first such conference we ever attended, and it was also Eddie Lama's first conference about animal issues. And I guess fate would have it that we connected, and he started to tell us his story. And pretty soon after he started to talk, we realized that something pretty special had come into our lives.
I mean, that's the one thing that's very noticeable in this is the charisma of Eddie Lama and how he manages to pull people into his life story. I wonder if you can kind of relate his charisma with the potential in all of us to make this kind of change and become almost the same sort of charismatic with a message that's strongly meant to us, and also how he can show us all that we're in the position to move ahead on these issues.
Eddie has a very thick Brooklyn accent. You know, people often say he sounds like someone who was on The Sopranos. And it's very charming. You know, when you hear someone who comes from such a tough background, who's been through so much in his life, speak with such tenderness about the vulnerability of animals and their suffering. And I think that the passion he has for advocating for the vulnerable really speaks to something profound in all of us. And I think that's why the film appeals to people. And I think that's also one of the reasons that a lot of people have watched the film and gone on to do something themselves about issues that they care about, is that people see Eddie in themselves.
Can you speak specifically about some of the audiences that have seen this and their reactions? I know you've shown it at college campuses and talked to some young people there, and maybe you could talk about some of the audiences that you've experienced with this.
The range of audiences that we've exposed the film to over the last 3 years has been pretty interesting, pretty remarkable. And, you know, the way you asked the question made me think of some of the extremes, in that we have had people show the film in correctional institutions, you know, boot camps, you know, full of young people whose lives have really taken a bad turn. And they relate to Eddie's having come from a tough background and overcome that. It has also been shown in a few corporate boardrooms. And there's one notable example of a case where it was shown to the board of directors of a shoe company, and the directors of the company were so moved by the film's message about animal suffering that they decided to develop a new line of cruelty-free footwear that did not use leather products. And not only that, did they want to develop this line of footwear, but they also were willing to connect it to the issue of animal compassion, which is pretty remarkable.
I mean, that brings me to another point. A few moments of the film show some undercover footage of slaughterhouses and trapping and fur farms. I'm really interested to see how filtering these images through Eddie's eyes and how the context of Eddie's life makes these difficult images a little more approachable for us, and how it makes it not just numbing, but empowering.
Right. That's another really interesting point. In our society, in our world right now, there are countless problems, poverty, nuclear proliferation, war, family violence. There's so many problems that are so difficult to face. and that when people are presented with documentation of these problems, it's often overwhelming. We're all so filled up with suffering. We're all so worn out by seeing the tragedy of life on this planet that the mere presentation of imagery depicting these truths is not necessarily helpful, because it oftentimes leaves people just feeling disempowered. And that's something that we study a lot at our organization, is how to present the truths in a context that actually is empowering. And the secret, we believe, is that there's actually two truths involved. There's the truth of suffering, and there's also the truth of our potential to rise above it and do something. And when you present the truth of suffering that's going on or injustice that's going on, and you also tell the story of someone who's facing that truth and doing something about it, I see time after time that audiences draw a great deal of strength from that experience, and they can take in a remarkably powerful presentation of the truth of suffering and still walk out of the viewing experience feeling, you know, somehow cleansed and inspired. So that's an emphasis that we have in our work.
I'm speaking with James Levesque. We are talking about The Witness, a documentary film that's going to be shown on WCNY on May 15th from 10 to 11 o'clock. This is the first screening for The Witness in this area, is the first widespread screening, isn't it?
It's the first broadcast in our home territory. As an organization based in Ithaca, though we're based here, we do most of our work at far-flung locations around the country, and we haven't been focused on exposing the film in the local region. And this is the first broadcast not only in the region but also in New York State. The other PBS broadcasts we have been in Miami, Denver, and Northern California.
That must be exciting for you to have it in your home area.
It's a pretty powerful experience to have a hometown screening. We did have a screening at the Environmental Film Festival held up at Cornell when we first brought the film out, but that was the largest screening that we had in the region. So this is a whole order of magnitude, a couple orders of magnitude bigger in terms of audience.
I understand there will be a debate after The Witness, the one that's being aired. Do you want to talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. The broadcast happening at WCNY on May 15th is going to be unique, both for being the premiere of the film for broadcast in New York State, and also because it's the first time that we know of that the fur industry has actually responded publicly to the film and its message. There will be a 15-minute program after the film, during which Eddie Lama, the film subject, will be joined by Rick Swain, the Vice President of Investigative Services at the Humane Society of the U.S., and two representatives of regional trapping and hunting organizations. And they are going to all sit and watch the film together, and then they're going to have a discussion, which will probably be somewhat of a debate, of the film and its message. And I think it's going to be a very interesting experience for viewers who have just taken in this 43-minute documentary about animal issues and animal suffering to hear from people who are involved in industries that are largely predicated on animal suffering. One other thing I wanted to add, too, about the film and its message and about the message of Eddie's life is that it's not just a film about compassion for animals. In the film, Eddie makes specific references to other social justice movements, particularly to the civil rights movement and slavery and the Holocaust. And he makes those references basically explaining why it's important to show the reality of what's happening. That in all these cases where these tremendous problems have been overcome to the benefit of our society, people had to look at some terrible truths and respond to them. And that in his own life, he overcame many prejudices, not just about animals, but certainly about people. He considers his compassion for animals as just a part of his worldview.
Well, I'll say this quote that he has in this leaflet. In my lifetime, I have been both the oppressor and the oppressed, both the fomenter of discord and the advocate for peace, both the perpetrator and the victim.
Eddie's sanctuary, he has an animal sanctuary now, largely funded by his construction company, that provides not only a home for abandoned and abused animals, but it also is a place where people who are in recovery from drug and alcohol addiction can spend some time in a very positive environment providing care for the animals. And those who have been rejected, abused, and abandoned as human beings have a particularly strong bond with animals who have been through the same kind of treatment. and there's just a magical symbiosis that occurs.
And now can we talk a little bit more about Tribe of Heart when you formed this organization and kind of what your message is and what you're hoping to accomplish in the years? I know that part of what you're really wanting to do is bring more and more people in to feel that they all can affect a change.
Sure. Tribe of Heart is a Ithaca-based charitable nonprofit, and we started the organization in 1997. And the purpose of our organization, ultimately, is to promote compassion for all beings, for all human and non-human life on this planet. And our vehicle for doing that is primarily the telling of stories of people who have had a dramatic transformation in their relationship to an oppressed group, and have then gone on to do something very positive to encourage others to adopt a similar change of heart. We think of ourselves as toolmakers, and what we like to do is use film to create educational tools that any person who feels moved by the cause that we're working for in any given case, any person can take that tool, go into their community, and be a very effective agent of education and change. Because there are so many people who feel the pain of the world, who feel bad about the injustices occurring, but have no means of really affecting change. And if you can show a film to a group of people and have people come up to you afterwards and say, you know, thank you for showing that to me, and as a result of seeing this film, I'm going to change my life in this way, in this way, in this way, that's a very wonderful experience. And once a person has felt that, they're never the same. They now know that by taking action, they can make a difference, at least in one person's life and often in many people's lives.
To learn more about the work of James Levesque and Jenny Stein, visit tribeofheart.org. You're listening to the Ithaca Radio Hour.
I laughed out loud and drew a crowd up to the steps where the ants are.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency estimates that there are over 5,000 community-based watershed groups around the country, and the number is growing. These volunteer organizations are undertaking important projects: ongoing monitoring of water quality, stream cleanups, and river restoration projects designed to protect local water bodies.
I think it's a real great way to understand your place and where you live, and everybody wants to have a high quality of life, and probably the easiest way or a good way to do it is to understand how your environment functions and how the watershed functions.
Jim Curatola is the coordinator of the Upper Susquehanna Coalition, a watershed group that spans 11 counties in New York and 3 in Pennsylvania.
Once you understand how things work, as you stand on that stream, look upstream at your watershed, you can understand a lot better how you can live and minimize problems that even locally, even within your small sub-watershed where you live in your house and your drainage, how things function so that you can live better with the natural environment.
Many of the threats to water come from what's called non-point source pollution, toxic chemicals and excessive fertilizer that can't be traced to a single source within the landscape. You can cite a factory discharging toxics directly into a creek. That would be a point source. But how do you identify the source of the extra fertilizer? Who is accountable for the silt that's brought to the lake by storm runoff? Paved roads and parking lots, driveways and sidewalks deliver runoff to creeks and streams much faster than it got there before the area was developed, and that damages stream banks, which aggravates flooding. What we call non-point source pollution is really the result of individual choices we've made and the choices we've made as communities. Again, Jim Curatola.
Historically, most projects are done on a county-town basis or on a state basis. And what we've found is that in non-point source pollution, and especially in the water quality arena, everything is really based on a watershed, a drainage basin. And one of the problems in New York, especially in flooding, the flooding originated in Pennsylvania. So the only really way to get a handle on developing a good project was to have all the folks involved and the entire landscape involved that was affecting those problems. And so what the coalition ended up doing is getting folks to not worry about the town, county, or state they're in, but look at an issue based on the sources of those problems or the sources of the water, and the watershed concept is the basis of the only way to do it.
A watershed is all of the land that drains into a particular stream, river, or lake. Small watersheds are nested within larger ones. Just as a small creek flows into a bigger stream, which in turn flows into a larger river, the watersheds for each of those watercourses are also connected. And the water we needed today has been used by upstream communities yesterday, and will in turn be used by downstream neighbors tomorrow.
The notion of being in the watershed has actually, I believe, changed the perspective of some of the longtime residents also, particularly the municipal officials in some of the villages who have seen no need for zoning, no need for any kind of regulation of septic systems or mined lands or forestry, etc.
Edith Davey is a Cornell Cooperative Extension educator working in the Canandaigua Lake watershed.
Because they have seen this as a local issue impacting only the people themselves. Well, it's on their land, let them do as they please. And the whole idea that what one person does or what one failed septic system does can impact a great many people has changed their perspective on that. They're much more willing to look at consequences of these sorts of things.
So why exactly are communities organizing watershed groups?
I think the growth, there's two reasons for it. First, that there's increasing public recognition of environmental problems, that a lot of the current problems are a shared responsibility of everyone and a little bit the cause of everyone.
Dr. Mark Bain is a professor at Cornell University and a specialist on water resources.
So that's one reason, I believe, public awareness and interest. And the second is there's increasing amount of state, federal programs aimed at developing watershed associations. There are funds available to communities, towns, people, if they have an organized group to seek those funds and help arrange their distribution and use. So I think the real value for the watershed associations that are emerging all over New York and the country are to be the organizer that interfaces between government programs and individuals and helps get the word out, helps organize the activities.
Because they cut across conventional political boundaries, watershed groups create new connections between communities and people from different backgrounds.
I believe one of the things that has changed as far as a sense of community is that people are much more aware of who their neighbors are in the watershed. We have a great influx of urban people into this watershed. It's been traditionally agricultural, particularly toward the southern end of the lake. That is changing rapidly. We are influenced heavily by the urban area to the north. We have people living in the watershed who have never been off of public sewers and public water sources before, who have only seen cows in books. And now they have rural neighbors who spread manure, who have interesting looking spray rigs out there, and they don't know what is being sprayed. And we are trying to help them learn about each other. It's been part of our process of education is trying to help the new residents learn about agriculture and its importance in the scheme of things.
Jim Curatola cites another example.
City of Binghamton, with its surface water supply, their actual community for their drinking water reaches all the way to Otsego Lake. And their Otsego Lake is a perfect example, a really clean lake. There's a really active lake association. They're doing great things in the ag field and the non-ag field. They're really keeping it clean for their own sake. But by doing that, they're really helping the folks in Binghamton and drinking that water when it gets to them.
As communities seek to restore and protect their environment, an awareness of local watersheds is a good starting point. Again, Mark Bain.
The quality of our waters is a measure of how we live on the land. And I think that summarizes why being concerned about stream and river health isn't just for the stream's benefit. It's like sort of the blood in your body. You can measure a lot of things about it. It tells you about the bigger picture, the landscape, the region, the whole place where we live.
Living in the Watershed was conceived, researched, and written by Theodore Eisenman for his master's project in natural resource management at Cornell University and co-produced with Tom Milligan of WSKG, Binghamton. The program is rebroadcast with permission from WSKG. To get involved with Cayuga Watershed Network, visit their website at cayugalake.org. You'll find more information on how home practices affect the watershed, a discussion of chlorination of public water supplies, and a threat of water chestnut invasion of the Finger Lakes. Tune in tomorrow night at 7 p.m. to hear U.S. Congressman Maurice Hinchey's report on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, following his April visit to the region, where he met with General Tommy Franks, Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat, and newly appointed Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. That's tomorrow at 7 here on WEOS. The Cornell Agriculture and Food Technology Park Corporation will hold a public meeting on Wednesday, May 14th, at Hobart and William Smith Colleges to brief members of the Geneva Town Board, City Council, and the community on progress in the park's development. The meeting will start at 7:30 p.m. in the Sanford Room of the Warren Hunting Smith Library on Pulteney Street in Geneva. The public is encouraged to attend. The Ithaca Health Fund annual meeting will be held May 16th at the Southside Community Center at 7 p.m. Hear Assemblywoman Barbara Lifton speak on the health insurance crisis, learn more about nonprofit member-owned health financing, and meet candidates for the Health Fund's board. For more information, visit Ithaca Health Fund's website at ithacahealth.org. A community conversation on transportation is being sponsored by the Curb Your Car Coalition for May 10th to 21st. May 15th is National Bike to Work Day, and May 17th there will be a bike safety rodeo for kids from 9 to 11:30 a.m. at Dryden Elementary. For a full listing of events, visit tompkins-co.org. On Sunday, May 18th, there will be a plant exchange at the Danby Fire Station on Route 96B from 12 to 4 p.m. This is an opportunity to swap, donate, and try new garden and house plants. For more information, call Dan Klein at 272-7582. Irish singer Karen Casey will be returning to Ithaca on Thursday, May 22nd, for a benefit concert for Ithaca Catholic Worker and Kuslar. Joined by Irish musicians Neil and Cillian Vallely, Karen Casey will perform at 7:30 p.m. at Culp Auditorium at Ithaca High School. Tickets are $18 and available at Small World Music, Kuslar, Alternatives Library, and Green Star Co-op. And don't forget to come to the Ithaca Fair Trade Fair this Saturday on the Ithaca Commons. This week's show was produced by Jesse Lind, Jeff Kirby, and Laura Ratzloff. Special thanks to Linda Orkin. Our theme music is an instrumental version of Circus by Crow Greenspun. During the show, we played music from Hubcap and the Sim Redman Band. For online information about the music we've played and contact info for calendar events we've announced, go to our webpage at ithacaradio.org/radiohour. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week.
The Ithaca Radio Hour is a project of Ithaca Community Radio and is produced at Rep Studio. For more information about ICR, visit our website at ithacaradio.org. You're listening to WEOS 89.7 Geneva, broadcast in Ithaca by ICR on 88.1, or WHRW 90.5 Binghamton.